It's time for the Picture House Podcast with your hosts, Sam and Simon. Please ensure that your mobile phone is switched off, refrain from smoking, and keep conversation to a minimum. So sit back, relax, and enjoy the show!
Hello, and welcome to the Picture House Podcast. My name is Simon, and I'm joined, as ever, by Sam. How are you, Sam?
Hello, I'm very well.
It's been a long time since we've been in the Podcave. It's as dark and dank and full of bats as ever it was.
I think we were last together over Christmas, but the weather is exactly the same as it was over Christmas.
Absolutely miserable.
Perfect cinema weather.
Perfect cinema weather.
A lot has happened in the last few weeks. We've been off for a while. We've had a few interview specials. We've had some great people on the show. A highlight for me over the last few weeks was talking to Lynn Ramsey, director of You Were Never Really Here.
What a director, and what a film.
I always thought she wasn't like so into doing press. I don't remember reading that many interviews with her for her previous films.
Yeah.
She's so much fun. She seems so nice. Oh, and also, I think she's so happy with how the film turned out.
Sure, I mean, you would be.
Yeah, exactly. You have to be.
It's such an amazing piece of work. I think it might be my favourite Joaquin Phoenix performance. Oh, no, wait. It's The Master.
Yes.
He's so good in The Master.
Well, he's pretty much good in everything. You know what not so great in, though? Mary Magdalene.
I mean, it's just a slightly pedestrian, run-of-the-mill affair that's quite dry and not especially entertaining. And I don't think that the JC character who Joaquin plays is particularly well drawn. So I feel like he hasn't got much to work with.
No, that's true. It does feel like he just had to turn up and stand and look longingly into the distance.
Yeah, look pensive.
In his robe. And then maybe dunk some people in a lake.
Yeah.
It's a lot of dunking.
Yeah, it's not great. No. It's not great.
Also, since we've last recorded, we went to our first sing-along together with The Greatest Showman.
It was The Greatest Sing-Along. That was really stunning.
It was so much fun.
It's one of the most fun 2 hours of my life, I think. That was the third time I'd seen the film, and it was genuinely special. I love that film with all my heart. It's crap, and it's the worst 5-star film I've ever seen.
Yeah, I think that's a fair review. I think what's amazing about the film is its staying power.
Yeah,
it's absolutely. Still in the, like, as of a couple of weeks ago, it was number 2 at the UK box office, and it opened on Boxing Day. It's been
amazing.
In the charts for like 10 or 12 weeks or something.
It's really impressive.
The album is still number 1. The singles are all in the like top 10.
It's got platinum.
It's insane.
Really, really special. Those songs are just, every single one of those songs, apart from maybe the Michelle Williams one, Tightrope, could win Eurovision.
A Greatest Showman themed Eurovision would be incredible. It was a great shame it didn't win the Oscar.
Yeah.
What
a
best song.
Perfect rewriting of history that totally etches out all of the awful things that P.T. Barnum did and creates something completely new from it, which is probably irresponsible, but hey, here are some great songs.
Yeah, it's like, who cares about historical accuracy?
The truth!
We've got some bangers.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, yeah, it's legit hashtag problematic, but so much fun if you ignore that and just suck up the gloss and the sheen.
Yeah, I think it would have worked if it wasn't about P.T. Barnum, if it was just about a circus man from that era.
Yeah,
because it's not about P.T. Barnum all. It's kind of crazy. I went on holiday for a little bit, which is one of the reasons we haven't recorded for a while.
Yeah.
But whilst I was away, The Greatest Showman was due to be released in Japan, and he was doing all of the press.
Was he in Japan?
In Tokyo. Yeah, he was in Tokyo. He was just walking around the streets, going into supermarkets, surprising people. And I would have loved to have seen the film with a Japanese audience.
That
sadly didn't quite make it. I did see the world's largest ad for The Greatest Showman.
Really?
Which was on the side of like a 10-story building which had an IMAX cinema inside.
Okay.
Sort of like a scale model of Godzilla on top.
Wow.
He's like Godzilla's climbing over the top of the building.
Blimey.
But now, he was actually climbing over a giant Hugh Jackman advert.
No way.
It was like the best thing I'd ever seen.
Wow.
The cinema was on a road called Godzilla Street.
Yes.
With Giant Hugh.
I love it.
But yeah, but whilst I was away, I bought you back a gift.
No.
A Tokyo gift.
Sam.
As is customary. And
what's
it's a great podcast gift because it makes a noise. So I got you one of these.
What on earth is that?
I'm passing over
my goodness.
The gift now.
What is this? It looks like a tiny sperm saxophone. That's what I'm looking at right here.
That's what it is.
Is that
what
it is? Hang on, how do I make it make a noise?
It's the internet's favorite musical instrument.
This is the best thing I've ever seen in my life. I don't know how to make it. I don't know how you make it stop. Hang on. Oh my God. Oh my God, I love it. I don't know.
You can look them up on the internet, listeners. It's called an automatone.
An automatone. Oh my God, it's the wedding march. I don't understand it, and I love it. It's the best thing I've ever seen. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
I love it, and I'm sorry for the noises. What else has happened in the last few months? We had the Oscars.
Oscars happened.
I stayed up for the Oscars again. That was stupid.
I went to bed, had a really good night's sleep.
Fair enough. I stayed up. Best picture was just before 5 a.m. Taxi home. Then up at 8 in the office at 9.
Here you are. I've sort of almost forgotten everything about the Oscars, but I did just remember Shape of Water 1, which I was surprised by.
It sure did.
And I enjoyed. I saw it a couple of days beforehand as part of my cramming exercise before the Oscars. Yeah, I was surprised it won. I really enjoyed it.
I think, I don't know, man. I think it sort of makes sense. I think it's a safe, comfortable film, like The Artist.
Yes, yeah.
That's really, really Academy fodder. That's classical Hollywood narrative, but crucially has all of these modern progressive things about it that really work for voters and audiences alike. And I don't know, I think it's like a new thing in old packaging.
Yeah, I see that. Like, definitely a lot of references to the sort of monster movies of the 50s. Yeah. And bigger, you know, like there's a whole black and white musical dance number in it.
Sure.
Which is quite fun. I mean, I guess it's also like, is it Guillermo del Toro's time? Is it one of those things? He's been around for ages. Maybe it's like, you know, the easy choice.
I saw it at LFF last year in August 2017. And I turned to the person I was watching it with as soon as it finished. I was like, that film's going to win Best Picture. And then I didn't put money on it. And then it did. And I'm an idiot.
Oh, but gambling's a mug's game, though.
Yep, never gambled in my life.
Maybe we should look to that sort of, like, we're in that sweet spot now after the Oscars.
Mm.
So we're not talking about the same old films that have been talked about for so long.
Thank God for that.
And we're in this sort of, like, pre-blockbuster sort of time with a couple of, like, indie wildcards thrown in. We've had some things in cinemas like Tomb Raider, and we've got Ready Player One very soon. Mm. And there's also things like The Square and Fantastic Woman have come in. So it's kind of like a nice time,
it's a good time
in the cinemas right now. There's lots of new films coming in, which means you have to be quick.
You really do. It's 2 weeks or bust in so many cases. You've really got to get to see stuff. We saw Tomb Raider.
I was really looking forward to it because we had Black Panther, sure, during the Oscar race, but it feels like that one has sort of petered out now. And there wasn't really any other blockbusters. And we were still playing things like Free Billboards and Lady Bird and all that, like, you know, which is good stuff. But I want some new stuff. What I quite like now is every week we're getting a big film. We've had Tomb Raider, and then we've had Pacific Rim 2, and we've got Ready Player One coming up. So as well as all the great indie stuff, there's also a big blockbuster seemingly every week.
Something for everyone.
So Tomb Raider, right? It's something that we quite like. We like the games.
We do.
Especially the new rebooted games that this new film, potentially new film series, or this new film especially, is based on. Also like the director's previous film.
Raw
Utang.
Yes.
He directed a film. He's a Norwegian director.
The Wave, is it?
Called The Wave.
Yeah, I've still not seen it, but you've seen it, right?
I saw it. I went on holiday to Norway like 2 or 3 years ago, and I'm a bit of a nerd when I go on holiday. I love going to see cinemas in other countries.
Oh, sure.
And I was like, what's the local cinema playing in this tiny Norwegian town we're staying in? They had adverts for Fast and Furious 8 or 7, I think.
Sure.
7, and then they had this film called The Wave. I was like, this film looks amazing. Mm. Why haven't I heard anything about it?
Mm.
And then a bit of Googling told me that it was Norway's most expensive film ever. And it was domestic production, and it was a huge special effects thing about a huge wave going through the fjords and tearing up Norway.
Wow.
And it was like a Roland Emmerich film, but good. So I was like following it, and I couldn't go see it on holiday because it wouldn't have had any English language in it. So I waited. And then about a year later, Studio Canal picked it up, and it basically went straight to DVD in the UK. There were a few special screenings, but I managed to go and see it at the LFF. Not a very well-attended screening at the LFF.
Sure.
Disaster films, I guess, aren't really the London Film Festival's audience's sort of vibe, but I went with a colleague. We snuck some beers in,
really
snuck some tinnies in.
Well done.
And we were watching a subtitled disaster film that felt kind of classy.
Yeah.
And I had such a good time.
It sounds great. I'd love to.
It's just like, it's a crazy concept. Like,
I hear that it's not just like trash, that it's actually like really well-directed silly stuff, right?
No, it's good. It's like a family drama, and like all of the good disaster films, like, you know, that you spend the first act really investing in the character, something happens, and then they bond and learn whilst running away from a big tidal wave. And there's a lot at stake. Like, it's so, the wave is really scary. Right. It's so big, and it looks really beautiful because Norway is such a beautiful country.
How does it stack up to, say, a geostorm?
It's sort of better and worse.
Sure.
It's a better film. Mm. It's a, like, it's actually good.
Yeah.
But it's not like belly laugh kind of fun, which Geostorm is. So they would maybe make a good double bill, but I would definitely do Geostorm at the end of that double bill, because you'd want to, like, that's the one to go out on. Nothing could follow Geostorm.
No, I mean, yeah, cinema could end at Geostorm and I'd be happy.
But yeah, so recommend The Wave. It's out on Blu-ray and it looks really beautiful. I've got the Blu-ray at home.
I've got to give it a go.
The UK distributor was very savvy, and they from the director of Tomb Raider on the front, even like 2 years ago, because that's when they knew he was going to be doing that.
Makes sense.
Which is kind of amazing, though, that he went from doing this Norwegian disaster film to doing the Tomb Raider reboot.
And it's a lot of fun.
Yeah.
We had a pretty good time, I think.
Yeah, so it's got Alicia Vikander takes over from Angelina Jolie, who played Lara Croft in the last two films.
They were both on iPlayer.
They still are.
Are they?
I think they're on there for five more months.
My God. I watched the first 5 minutes of Cradle of Life, the sequel, and it just turned it off.
Ooh. I remember even when I was a teenager that the second one wasn't very good.
I'd had enough.
No, the first one was... like, also not great. There's some really bad CGI, you know, like CGI in the 90s that was so unconvincing, especially if you're watching it in like HD now. Mm. There's a lot of stuff where Angelina Jolie is running away from something which feels like it's a million miles away from her.
Right,
it looks like she's running away from a cartoon robot for a lot of it. Yeah, it wasn't so good. And it just kind of made me appreciate this new film a little bit more. Like, it's a video game adaptation that they take very seriously.
Yes, and it does feel quite faithful to those two new games.
Yeah.
In that Lara is very sort of witsy. It does a good puzzle to action balance.
Yep.
The character is well drawn, and a lot of the set pieces really do feel like they could be straight out of the latest games. And I think, for the most part, it's well put together. It's a very well-directed action film, I would certainly say that. I think Alicia Vikander's very good at all of the running and jumping and the climbing trees and the shooting the bad guys and the getting out of the holes. I'd say that perhaps I was slightly disappointed in the puzzles. I think the puzzles quite work in the fun, mind-meldy way that they work in those new games. They could have just done with a little bit more thought. I think
even more puzzles as well. I can only really remember one or two actual puzzle set pieces.
Exactly.
But the fatal flaw with the film is they don't really explain the logic of the puzzles to you as an audience. Like,
they just sort of happen.
Lara solves them.
Oh, she solved it. How does she do that? Okay, cool.
It's not like if you watch, you know, good like game shows which have puzzles in, like Crystal Maze or The Cube, you know how the games work, so you can be really invested in it. And in this, they just make up the rules on the spot, which is a shame.
I was thinking about cinema's greatest puzzles after we went to see the film, and I was thinking about the gallons of water puzzle in Die Hard with a Vengeance, which I think is actually potentially cinema's greatest puzzle. The rules are set out really well. It's complicated, but it's not too difficult if you really think it through, and it's deeply satisfying once the puzzle is solved. And I don't think we have that quite in Tomb Raider. But there's all sorts of other bits and pieces to enjoy. Dominic West is playing Lara Croft's father, and he's having a hoot.
He's having a great
time. He's doing a lot of acting.
He thinks he's in the Angelina Jolie Tomb Raiders.
Yeah. He really does. No Chris Barry this time around.
No, it's a shame. Although the butler in the games, the older games, and in those films, she had a butler to her giant mansion. And we don't really see the estate in this one. So there is still time.
Could be in the second one.
Chris Barry could come back.
He certainly could. I hope he does. We've got Kristen Scott Thomas in a supporting role, which is fun. We've got Derek Jacobi in a supporting role.
Yeah, that's crazy.
Fantastic.
Doing a role like that anyone could be doing. Unless they've got big plans for him for the sequel.
I mean, maybe. I mean, he really is there to say, "Good morning, Ms. Croft. Sign here, please."
Yes.
That's it.
That's all
Jacobi's bringing
to it. It's a good paycheck for him.
Great day.
Probably made an action figure for him now. Derek Jacobi, the secretary. It feels like it's quite as... it's all about Lara, which is really good. I wish the villain had like a little bit more of a link to her. He feels really underdeveloped. We don't see him for so long.
It's a bit of a cut
and then he's kind
villain.
Of small scale, because it's not really about him. It's about her and her dad. But I do wish we were a bit more invested in him, because he was just like a like mustache twirling two-dimensional bad guy.
And I would say that it's also a fun addition to have some fantastical stuff in there as well. You know, you open a coffin or whatever and there's some stuff that happens. So, you know, it's fun to include that stuff. Has it been very commercially successful? I think
it was pretty busy for about a week.
Okay.
Like, it's still doing fine. I really hope it gets to a point where it's deemed successful enough to do a sequel, because this feels like there's a lot of really good groundwork here.
Yes.
And, you know, like, I think this is something that could grow. We could have a really good sequel to this. Now we know the character, we know her backstory.
I agree. It would feel very natural to have a sequel.
And I'd love the director to be attached also. Yeah. I think Roar Wu-Tang has done a great job, and I'd love to see him sort of build on this character.
All right, what else is coming up? What else is coming up? What else have we had?
So we briefly spoke about You Were Never Really Here at the beginning, but do you want to... I know you are a big fan of You Were Never Really Here, and you've recently rewatched it.
I have. I've had a couple of goes on this now. I saw it at LFF last year, and I saw it on opening night a couple of weeks ago, and I think it's a really impressive piece of work. Not least because there is an exceptionally talented team on board here. You've got Lynn Ramsey directing. You've got a Lynn Ramsey screenplay. You've got a Johnny Greenwood score. You've got Tom Townend on as DP. You've got Joaquin in front of the camera. I mean, it's a dream team. And this film is, I think, 89 minutes long. And the beauty of that, it couldn't be a minute longer, because I've seen it twice. And it's so unbearably tense and electric throughout. Both my arms end up wrapped around my body in just full, abject terror tension. It's quite an experience. It's like going on a really unpleasant roller coaster for 90 minutes, but also one that is like a mad lucid dream that is terrifying. I always remember going to a Q&A that Ben Wheatley was doing for Kill List, and he was asked where his idea for the film had come from. He said that he based Kill List on the stuff of his nightmares. So his nightmares were people running at you in the dark with hammers, and cults, like sacrificial cults, and dinner parties. And it fits. And I think this is another nightmare turn.
It's a real experience, isn't it?
Like, it's
quite hard
horrible
to describe, and also I don't think it's something you necessarily want to describe, because it's so great. I think the first time we both saw this was in a festival, and we maybe didn't really know too much about it before going in. We wouldn't have seen a trailer or anything.
I knew almost nothing.
And it's so fun to be part of this film that takes you in really unexpected directions.
Yes.
In a really unexpected way. Like, I think it's so well shot. And it feels, because it's set in New York, but it feels like it's set in real New York. It's really grimy. It's really gritty. It's usually quite close on the characters, and you can see like the dirt and the sweat on their faces.
It's a deeply unpleasant film.
Mm.
I did not enjoy the experience both times. It is an exceptional piece of work, I think.
It's my favorite Joaquin Phoenix performance for a really long time.
He's fantastic, and a lovely example of that film is all showing and no telling. Mm. There's so little dialogue.
Yeah.
It's just beautifully put together, really well shot, a stunning, scary, creepy, propulsive score.
I really love that score. I think that Johnny Greenwood's on a roll this year with Phantom Thread and You Were Never Really Here, but I've seen the trailer for You Were Never Really Here quite a lot, and the track they use in the trailer, it's just like what stays in my brain after seeing the film.
Yeah. Oh, it's tough stuff.
It's really good. And it's quite unlike anything I've heard Johnny Greenwood do previously as well. Mm. It's so different to the Phantom Thread score.
It's the opposite of the Phantom Thread score, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's something else. I can't recommend it enough.
So with You Were Never Really Here, it's been out for a little while now, and it is still playing in quite a few cinemas, but you have to go and see it soon. I highly recommend seeing it on the big screen. So we've got Tomb Raider, we've got You Never Really Here. There's a couple of big films out at the end of March. We've got a new Wes Anderson film.
Yes, I Love Dogs.
I Love Dogs.
Everyone loves dogs. Now, I haven't seen I Love Dogs, but you've seen I Love Dogs.
I saw I Love Dogs when I got back from Japan. Like, it was the first film I saw. Perfect. And it was like Japan was following me around because this film is a stop motion animation film set in a future Japan. It's not really discussed when, but it's just a future Japan where there's a sickness that's carried through dogs. So the government decides to put all the dogs on Trash Island. Yeah. And then they're joined by a small boy called Akira, who is looking for his lost dog Spots. And then it's like a fun romp with this boy and five dogs trying to find Spots.
It seems like a lot of fun. The dogs can speak English.
The dogs all speak English and the humans all speak in Japanese.
Okay.
And it's said at the beginning of the film, in a Wes Anderson kind of knowing way, that dogs speak English. So as a viewer, it's interesting. Like, the Japanese characters are presented with subtitles, so you are meant to know what they're saying, the dogs are meant to know what they're saying, then the dogs can talk back in English, and I think the humans don't understand what the dogs say. Okay. They sound like barking.
So this is Wes Anderson's second stop-motion animation film after Fantastic Mr. Fox, which I wasn't particularly keen on. Does it feel like Fantastic Mr. Fox, or does it feel like it has its own identity?
Yeah, no, it's really, it's kind of funny, because it is, it's another, this film was made in the UK, it was made in Stratford, yeah, at Free Mill Studios, which did Frankenweenie, and I love that these big Hollywood films are filmed in Stratford, yeah, and the craftsmanship is so good. There's actually an exhibition on in London, it finishes on like the 5th of April on the Strand, where you can see some of the sets, and you can get really close to them and see how beautiful they are. Everything is made by hand.
Amazing.
Even like tiny little sake bottles and like sushi and stuff. It's amazing. Fantastic Mr. Fox has that as well, like this kind of like really glorious kind of stop motion look and feel. Like the models are so nice. I feel like with Fantastic Mr. Fox, I didn't really love the script. I didn't think Wes's sensibilities worked with Roald Dahl's source material.
No, I agree.
It was a weird fusion. This is a completely original story, and it's co-written by Roman Coppola and Jason Schwartzman, who are regular Wes Anderson collaborators. So it just feels like a 100% Wes Anderson feel. It doesn't quite have that sort of jarring sensibility to it. So I think it's easier to follow in that respect. Mm. Your brain isn't doing this weird, like, but I know the book of Fantastic Mr. Fox, and this isn't what Roald Dahl would have done. You know, like, you're sort of fully, you know, you're in a Wes Anderson film. It's it feels more like latter-day Wes. Like, it's very similar in terms of, like, pacing to Grand Budapest Hotel and Darjeeling Limited. And the jokes are good. There are some really good jokes in this film.
Oh, I'm glad.
Which is really important. It's a nice runtime. I think it's like 100 minutes or something. Like, it doesn't outstay its welcome. And I was really kind of blown away by how it looked. And I really, the score is very overpowering, but I really enjoyed it.
Who is it? Is it
Desplat? Yeah, of course it is. Regular Wes Anderson collaborator. And it's got like a few different beats. There's lots of traditional Japanese stuff in there, big drums. Mm. Then there's also a lot of like American folk music sort of stuff as well. And the score is a fusion of Americana and this like Japanophilia.
It really sounds like a Wes Anderson film.
Yeah, I mean, it's very Wes Anderson-y. Yeah. I think also because it's a stop motion film and everything is crafted, is handcrafted. It's even more Wes Anderson-y than a live action film, because the actors are they have their own sort of values, and in this everything is put through the Wes Anderson filter.
Sure.
So I think if you like Wes Anderson, you'll really like this film. If you don't, I mean, you're going to see the most Wes Anderson-y film you could possibly go and see. Sure. And it's got a lot of Wes Anderson regulars in there, Bill Murray, Jason Schwartzman. Bryan Cranston is a new addition to the Wes family.
No way.
And he's very good. He's one of the lead dogs in the film.
One of the top five dogs.
I really enjoyed him. I would have liked Owen Wilson to have popped up, just because he's in everything,
Owen
right?
No Owen Wilson.
There's a few good sort of cameos from Wes people in there, which I won't ruin. Although if you see the poster, I think they've listed all of the cast.
Still.
I quite liked it. I have heard there's a few people out there who have not enjoyed it so much, and I think that's totally understandable if you're not a Wes fan.
Yeah, there's a big conversation about cultural appropriation and how far the film goes and what it's saying and what it's doing. I'd be very interested to see it for myself and make my mind up.
Yes. And then we're about to go, listeners, to go and watch Ready Player One.
It starts in 8 minutes.
The new Steven Spielberg film, which I have already seen, and Simon has not seen.
And I'm about to miss the first 10 minutes. I mean, but that's okay, right? Because it's 140 minutes long.
Yeah,
he needs to see the first 10 minutes.
Yeah, it's fine.
I've seen. I read the book. We both read the book.
Yes, read the book. Ernest Cline's book, his debut novel, came out in like 2011. And I think it was one of those books which was snapped up as soon as it was published.
Sure was.
It was a sort of great seller.
And this feels like a very much a spiritual sequel to The Post.
Absolutely.
Spielberg's last film. Gives with one hand and he takes away with the other.
It's crazy that we get, like, space of 3 months, we've had two Spielberg films.
Yep. That's mad.
I know you weren't such a fan of The Post. I saw The Post twice.
I thought it was okay.
Second time I saw The Post, I loved it.
Did you?
I came out loving it.
I have seen it twice. I saw it once with my flatmates and once with my mum.
Oh, did you love it the second time?
It was pretty good. I like the first hour. It's just like classic late Spielberg worthy earnestness that in the third act that I find a bit saccharine.
It was a good speech, though, wasn't there?
Yeah.
When Meryl, I mean.
Yeah,
the
Meryl speech is very good.
I sort of love the blocking in that scene, though, like, because it's Meryl in a room with loads of men, and, like, they're all, like, clamoring over each other
well
to be in
together shot.
Like, I thought the cinematography, I don't know if I think it was Kaminsky, Spielberg's regular DOP, thought it was so well shot, considering it's all shot in, like, really boring houses and offices. It made it look really cinematic.
Has Yannis done Ready Player One?
You know what? I don't know.
Ooh, question. Does it feel like you could have a sequel to Ready Player One? Ooh. AKA Ready Player 2.
Ready Player 2. I guess so, but this is a self-contained film. Like, because okay, you could just use... The universe is rich. The Oasis, which is
I remember what happens,
like, it's such a rich space. Sure. Yeah, like, I'd love to see more films set in here. There isn't a follow-up novel, so it would be a completely original sort of joint, which might be better.
I'm very intrigued to see it. I wasn't jumping up and down for the book, and I feel like this film looks like it's not for me. But I'm going in with the most open mind. But you were a fan, right? You liked it?
I think my condensed review, I guess, is like, this feels like a really Spielberg-y project.
Yeah.
But I think as an audience, maybe we've seen this kind of thing before.
Sure.
I think if this came out, obviously it couldn't have done because the book was only written in 2011, but if this came out like 20 years ago, like, it would be more significant than it is now. Mm-hmm. A lot of the ideas we've had that were in the book have sort of been done a bit now.
Absolutely.
A lot of the book, I think the reason a lot of people like the book is because of the nostalgic elements. The book is set in like 2045, mm-hmm. but the 80s are really popular in this dystopian sort of universe. So mm-hmm. there's lots of 80s callbacks, and it's all mm-hmm. set in this game where the designer of the game loves 80s culture, and it's full of 80s kind of references. So, like, that's the sell. Yeah. And a lot of people who are reading, you know, books in 2011 also grew up in the 80s, and I think it just resonated.
Yeah.
Since then, though, we've had a whole lot of nostalgia in cinema.
Yeah.
Star Wars has been rebooted in that time and all of that sort of stuff. And I don't know, like, maybe now it's sort of coming to the end of that nostalgia kind of thing. Like, we want to see new things. We've seen this before.
We were all excited about Marvel films when they started making Marvel films, and now I've fully reached oversaturation points where
Marvel.
I'm just done. But yeah, I see what you mean.
I think the time it's taken to make this film, because they shot it such a long time ago, again, when you see it, you'll understand half of the film is set in this amazing virtual world, which is so beautifully rendered. Like, it's some of the best CGI I've ever seen. It's flawless.
Wow.
And when it's Spielberg, you know, he's such a pro at this now. Yeah. You know, the whole reason he could make the post when he did it is because it was also doing the visual effects for Ready Player One.
Yeah, yeah.
So for a year, they're just doing this, and he's made a whole other film and released
it.
So yeah, like, that stuff's amazing. I kind of preferred the stuff in the video game where the characters are playing as their avatars, so it's like a CGI rendering of them.
Yeah.
I kind of prefer all that stuff to the live action stuff where
you
get the real life, you know, Ty Sheridan and Olivia Cooke and all that.
Ben Mendelsohn.
Ben Mendelsohn, you know, and like, there's some good stuff. I think Ben Mendelsohn's quite a good villain in this. But I think the younger cast aren't the... they're all good actors in their own right. You've got Ty Sheridan's been amazing in films like Mud.
Sure.
Olivia Cooke was in Me and Earl and the Dying Girl and was very good in that. I think in this they get a bit lost. I don't think they quite have the weight. Like, Mendelsohn is such a pro. He can like punch above all of the, you know, the sci-fi kind of gubbins. And I think those guys get a bit lost. Bit of a shame.
That's
I wish we had stronger casting on the younger actors.
Yeah.
But I'm looking forward to rewatching it with you because I want to see all of the set pieces again. I just think
the
visual
eggs. I'm
going to
be,
great.
Shouting all the Easter eggs out when they turn up.
It's one of those films where, like, because in the same in the book, they're referencing lots of known properties. There's lots of other IPs in here, and same in the film as well. And like, some stuff is quite fun to see, like, oh, it's the thing from The Thing. Mm. But there's so much of it in the film. Like, does it count if they just put something on screen for a few seconds? Like, is that a clever reference?
No.
It feels a bit lazy.
It's not clever.
Well, some things are built into the plot, and I was kind of impressed by those. It's like, oh, that makes sense, because I know that character from another thing. But if I quickly see, I don't know, someone jumping on screen who I recognize from a TV show, I was like, fine.
It's
not clever. Yeah. So it's really, I love reading all the reviews to this film, though. Like, again, it's something that's divided critics. There's a lot of people who really, really love it.
Yeah.
And it's really interesting to see their, like, reading their takes on the film, because it's not quite how I felt. They were saying it's a really significant moment in cinema, and, you know, to get to this point, and it's maybe it's about Spielberg's own career. He's a man in his 70s now, and this is all about a creator whose kind of creation has run wild, and is that what Spielberg's doing? And I love that reading of the film. I didn't quite get that from it, but I did think it was a fun ride. And I'm looking forward to watching it again.
Me too. I tell you what, Sam, my flatmate bought an Oculus Rift a couple of weeks ago.
God.
And I spent a lot of time in that Oculus Rift. And it's so much fun, regardless of what you're doing. Even if, like, it's a game where you have to hoover a living room, it is so much fun.
Wow.
And I think I'm gonna stay in the Oasis. Do you remember Second Life about 10 years ago?
Yeah.
People like getting married in Second Life. I think that's what I'm up for this afternoon.
Nice. Well, maybe we should wrap up the pod and we should go into the Oasis.
Oh, God, it literally starts in 1 minute.
I mean, it's really soon. We don't want to miss the beginning. There's lots of important information at the beginning of the film.
There's a Silvestri score, right?
Yeah, yes, so it's not John Williams.
I'm assuming that the Silvestri score is like nods to, I don't know, is Indiana Jones and then some Indiana Jones music and... Here's Sonic the Hedgehog and there's Sonic the Hedgehog music and...
I don't think it's a spoiler to say... Oh, maybe Sonic the Hedgehog is in the film. I don't think Sonic the Hedgehog is in the film.
Yeah, fair enough. No, I'm sure he isn't, but you know
there is. Silvestri does acknowledge some of his previous work, yes. Bet. Yes. Spielberg also acknowledges some of his previous
work. Oh, in the trailer there's Back to the Future music.
Yes.
Yeah, it makes sense. Okay, good. Let's go.
Okay, we're going to go to the cinema, listeners.
You should do the same thing.
Yes, please do. There's lots of good stuff on.
When this podcast ends, just put your podcast down. And by podcast, I mean phone or iPod Nano, and take yourself to the cinema. It's grim outside. Go.
Yeah, it's good cinema weather. Thank you for listening, listeners, and we will be back with a new podcast very soon. We'll get Simon's thoughts on Ready Player One. I'm looking forward to watching you watching the film. That's what I will do.
It's going
to
be a lot of fun.
We'll see you soon.
We'll see you soon. Thanks, guys. Bye.
Goodbye.
This is the worst podcast we've ever recorded.